The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On Friday, August 23rd, Samuel Jamier, the Korea Society's Senior Program Officer for Contemporary Issues in Corporate Affairs, sat down with Robert R. Cagle, Assistant Professor of Cinema Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, to talk about the future of the Korean Wave and his research on melodrama.
So, Robert Cagle, how did you get into studying Korean melodrama?
I've done work on film for a long time. I originally wrote about, when I first focused on national cinema, I was doing work on Canadian film and how Canadian film, English language Canadian film, was a response to Hollywood, because it seemed that there was this sensibility that was being exhibited in a number of English language Canadian films, especially from the 1980s during the Canadian New Wave, that seemed to be explicitly responding to the kind of Hollywood monopolization of Canadian screens and of Canadian national identity. And so that was my first real work with national cinemas. Before that, I had focused more, well, I'd done some work on French and German film, but I focused more on film theory issues, issues of gender and representation, and sometimes genre work. And after my work on Canada, I started doing work on the melodrama, and as I was slowly introduced to Korean film through friends and colleagues, I began to pick up the sense that there was this strong melodramatic tradition. It was obvious from the beginning. And so I think the first film I wrote about was a piece on bungee jumping, which struck me as being the perfect film to write about for a study of melodrama. And I decided to do a large-scale project where I examined films from different types of, that appeared to be from different types of genres, action films, comedies from Korea that also exhibited melodramatic tendencies, and how that worked. So what I've come to realize is that, like the American melodrama that Linda Williams talks about, how the American melodrama reflects a specifically American ethos, the American ideology, and that every American melodrama comes to be about, you know, the country proving itself, there is a same kind of common formula in Korean melodramas as well, but it's decidedly different. So, I mean, it's similar in the fact that we can find the same kind of messages time and again in films, but it's different in that because the nation is so different, because the ideology is so different from the U.S., then it's different than American melodrama.
You seem to see melodrama as something that goes across genres and defines the whole Korean film industry. Am I correct?
To a certain degree, yes. Yeah, I think that that melodrama, because what happens in melodrama is the film tries to express a great number of things at once and fails. Melodrama is always about failure on some level, and Korean melodramas usually deal with the failure of communication. There's the central conflict that happens in the film is that somebody refuses to say something or does not say something, and that sets everything into motion, and what follows after that, the tragedies that follow after that, are all based on other miscommunications. And so to me, that was both symbolic of the mode itself, of the melodramatic mode, and also an important commentary, I think, on the culture and the industry that produced it.
At this juncture, Korean melodramas are extremely popular in Asia, in China in particular, and in Japan, of course. To what would you attribute that success?
I think part of it is simply the focus on melodrama, because melodrama tends to be about the human condition. comedy doesn't translate well because comedy is based on linguistic plays and culturally specific messages. Horror is different in other countries. I mean, what we think is scary, somebody else might not. And we see that in reactions to when horror films from abroad are viewed as being camp or funny. The only thing I think that really does transcend national boundaries are these stories about the human condition, and I think that melodrama is the ideal mode for that. What has happened with these Korean melodramas, the TV dramas and the films, is that they've managed to create narratives that are really global in their appeal, transnational, that when people see them, they're able to pick up and engage with them at different places. The strength, though, is that while they tell global stories, they're also doing so in such a way that introduces all of us to very interesting things about Korea's culture, Korea's history, Korea's past. Right. And it doesn't keep us from enjoying it. It just helps us learn. So I think that there is the sort of mania for Korea that we're experiencing right now is sort of piggybacking on this interest in these global stories. The people are really sympathizing with the stories, identifying with the stories, and along with that, they're finding an interest in this culture that's giving them such pleasure.
Despite this critical and popular success of the Korean pop culture in Asia, recently there seems to have been some kind of backlash against Korean pop culture. Well, what do you think about it?
I think the problem is the backlash that we're seeing. Like, for example, the books that have been published in Japan, the hate the Korean way of things, is simply because Japan has always been, I mean, Japanese culture has always been a very strongly nationalistic culture on some level. And I think that given the rather difficult relationship the two countries have had, the popularity of Korean drama, especially with the demographic group that it was popular with, older women. So I think that too was problematic. And so I think the backlash we're seeing is from younger men. The sort of target audience that we see for Hollywood films, and maybe it's just that they're uncomfortable with the fact that these older women have, on some level, that these older women have sort of defined what the popular culture of the nation is. And it could also be, you know, again, just the sort of nationalistic backlash that we see all the time with different things. But I do think that there will be continued popularity of Korean products no matter what.
Some critics, some people have argued that the storylines of these melodramas, these films, are becoming exhausted, that we're running out of storylines because they're too formulaic. Would you agree with this?
Well, actually, I was just thinking about that because, you know, they've run out of ways to get amnesia, so now people are getting Alzheimer's at 25 in these dramas. But there's always some way to separate the present from the past. I don't know. I think there are infinite ways to address the rift between past and present, between a sort of ideal life or an idealized past and an unpleasant present. I think that they'll find ways to do that and make it fresh every time. I've watched a ton of them, and while some of them, for example, Something Happened in Bali, seem to be more, more cognizant of social and critical issues. At one point, a character is quoting Gramsci, which I think is amazing. You know, you wouldn't find somebody quoting Gramsci on American TV. Something like Fashion 70s that was so strongly critical of the American military presence in Korea. Again, we don't find that same kind of thing in other national entertainments. They find ways to play with these historical events, these political issues, in ways that are then incorporated back into these larger stories, melodramatic narratives about the loss of the past that keeps them fresh and that keeps them cutting edge in a way.
Are you worried at all about the end of the Korean wave?
I worry that it'll become more like Hollywood. I worry that it'll take the route that Indian film did, because South Korea and India are the only two countries in the world whose domestic industries have been able to hold their own against Hollywood. And what we've started to see with Indian film is that they've taken on this sort of cynical edge. They've tried to imitate Hollywood, and everything is a sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge attitude. And it's not at all entertaining. And what I find most satisfying about these South Korean projects is they have the same kind of sincerity that old Hollywood projects did. There's not this sense that, oh, this is melodramatic and it's really camp. There's not even the same kind of, it's not self-consciousness, but there's not the same kind of cynicism necessarily that we see in works even like Douglas Sirk that were made in the 50s. There's a very real, and I think that is because there's a very real commitment to telling these stories. There's a very strong belief in the value, the cultural value of cinema as an art form, and even television as a cultural artwork or as a work of cultural import. And I think that's what makes them continue to be important. If there is a change toward more sort of Hollywoodization, I think that would be the death of it, yes.
But isn't that the case? What about Hollywood?
I think we're seeing, yes, instances. I think that D-War will probably fail miserably here. I think people will dislike it, especially given that we've got that J.J. Abrams movie about something that nobody knows what it is, you know, 1808 or whatever, that, you know, that some monster is going to be attacking New York. And that's going to be the monster film of the year, unfortunately. But I think the D-War, I was very disappointed to see, you know, that they got American actors and that they were trying to make this appeal when, in fact, they've done very well appealing first to a domestic audience and then finding an international audience. There's no reason to pander to English speakers or to the American public, I think.
American TV shows like Grey's Anatomy, Prison Break, have been enjoying tremendous popularity in Korea lately. The show by J.J. Abrams, Lost, is extremely popular. How do you think that would influence the Korean media?
I hope that they don't have too great of an influence, honestly, because production of Lost is enough. You know, I don't think we need copies of it. And I hope that Korean television doesn't go the way of American TV and go to, you know, all reality programming. Although there is some, you know, interaction with stars. I can't remember the name of the TV show where everybody, they play sort of silly games. Is it Love
Letter?
Yeah.
X-Men.
Yeah. I think there's bound to be some sort of an influence, yes, but I hope that at the same time, because of the immense popularity in certain populations or certain demographic areas, I hope that there will be some sort of an influence of Korean television on American. I think it's unlikely, because I think there's the assumption that if something is made in Hollywood or made as part of American media culture, that it is just part and parcel of the production, that it's global. You know, there's the idea that a Hollywood film is not made for the United States, it's made for the world, whereas a film made in another country is made for that country, and if it becomes popular outside of the national boundaries, well, good for it. But there's not the sense that it's speaking to a global audience. But I would like to see some of the same things that we're seeing in Korean drama get picked up here, if only by a few people, just to experiment with and see how it goes.
But isn't that already the case with The Lake House, for example? Don't you think it's exploitation in many ways?
It is. Yeah. Well, I do think it's exploitation, because I think that if the American production companies or distributors are willing to invest that kind of money to remake it, then why not just invest a little bit and distribute the original film, you know? It's really unfortunate that a lot of Americans think that Shall We Dance or that Arnold Schwarzenegger film where he's a spy, it's based on a French film.
True Lies.
Yeah, it was called True Lies.
True Lies was adapted from a French film.
Yeah, and the French film was actually far more interesting because it was just this banal reality of life story. There was none of the sort of explosive pyrotechnics that you got in True Lies, and that's what made it really interesting, you know. But there's no sense that The Ring, even. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize that was first a Japanese film, that they think it was something American. And worse yet, when American films are remade, for example, in the last year, a lot of the most interesting old horror films from the 70s, Black Christmas, The Hills Have Eyes, have been remade. And a lot of people are completely unaware that there are these cutting-edge, very disturbing and yet very valuable, interesting films made at that time period in the late 70s that set up this whole movement toward that direction. They're unaware that there's a basis that way. So I think on some level it's exploitation. I think it's really disappointing. I saw The Lake House, and everything that was interesting about it, everything that was good about it, ended up being taken out. Even the dog was ugly, and that's what really bothered me the most, was that Cola was so cute in the original, and they had this big old ugly yellow dog. And that neither of the stars had any of the appeal of the original actors, and there was no sense of chemistry. And the fact that we understood in the Korean original that they were writing these letters back and forth, but that in the Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves version, they're actually at some point addressing one another. Yes. And the whole time-space continuum thing gets screwed up when he plants that tree outside and it grows overnight, and you know, and she comes home and, oh, wow, thank you for planting that tree. Come on, you know. I know that it's a fantasy, but I'm only willing to give them so much room, and right. I had to stop. If I weren't stuck on a plane, I would have turned it off. I'll put it that way.
Now, what do you think about the presence of Korean actresses and actors in U.S. productions? We have the case of Lost, I just talked about J.J. Abrams before, but there's also Chan Ji-hyun in Blood, which would come out very soon. Do you think that would help? That would help the Korean wave at all?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that if they really want to do this, I think it's good, but by and large, I think if you look at Hollywood film and American film in general, it focuses so heavily on white middle-class characters. I think it'll be very, very difficult for them. And I think that especially we see a great deal of difficulty in mainstream film to deal with Asian characters. I think there's a real problem there to the point where even Asian films that are remade in the U.S., Dark Water, The Ring, there are no Asian characters. And when asked about this, people who worked with production said, well, if it called for Asian characters, we could put them in. And the question becomes, when does it call for an Asian character? Why is it that there are only certain roles that are given to these people? You know, why is it that Asians are relegated to only playing certain roles? And I worry that these performers who have shown themselves to be so diverse in Korean film that they can come to the U.S., and I'm worried they're going to be at best stereotyped and not allowed to play the same breadth of roles that they've been playing before. Because historically, it seems like that's what's happened.
Now, I would like to hear a little more about your own research. You recently contributed to a collection of articles appropriately entitled Soul Searching. Can you talk about your contribution in this book, and who was the publisher?
SUNY, State University of New York Press. Francis Gateward edited a collection of essays called Soul Searching. And it contains essays on a lot of very important Korean films, a lot of iconic films, but films that have not been discussed recently as well. And so the piece I wrote was an analysis of Bungee Jumping of Their Own. And in that, I was looking at the way that the cyclical narrative of the film reflected a sort of play of gender identities that happens in the film. That when we're watching the film and we see the character of the school teacher first in love with the girl from college, and then she disappears, and then he becomes fascinated, obsessed with this 17-year-old guy that's in his class. We know that X number of years have passed between the woman disappearing and the current date. And it seems like, logically looking at it, because he looks like her, he seems like her, that, and I would assume in a Hollywood film probably, there would be the assumption that this is the product of their union at the Love Motel that we see, you know, prior to him going away to the army. But instead, it's a film about reincarnation. And, you know, you sort of doubt it. I mean, there it's all the way up to that last scene where they meet each other in front of the train and you see the reflections, you sort of think this guy's crazy. He's just imagining the whole thing. And then the film does that nice turn, and it really is. You see the flashback to the past. You see how the girlfriend is accidentally hit by a truck. And then you see the 17-year-old going through the same thing again. And so when they finally do go to jump off of the bridge where people bungee jump, and they jump without the cord, there's this really liberating sense that they're doing something that's beyond a lot of the sort of cultural imperatives that under which they've been living. And then the film takes off, and you've got this free floating camera that opens the film. And literally the ending is the same as the beginning. You've got this nice cycle where you just start again. And the film makes you reinvest and watch it over again. And I just think it's a really fascinating film. Not many films do that.
Now, if you don't have any objections, I would like to hear your opinion about a somewhat delicate subject matter, which is the screen quotas in Korea. There's been a number of U.S. blockbusters have come out in Seoul, in Korea, and they've been doing pretty well. So the Korean film industry has been pretty worried about this matter. What do you think about the reduction of the screen quotas?
I think it came at a really difficult time. The screen quota, I think, originally in the 60s was probably, and I think the other historians would agree, was aimed originally at helping to build an economic base, helping to create an industry where there really was not one, you know, at the time. But I think it's become a symbol of something more recently, that it's a symbol of Korea being able to hold its own against Hollywood. And so when it was announced the screen quota would be slashed to half, not only people in the industry, but I think a lot of viewers were really angry and very upset and feeling like, you know, the industry was being sold up the river in order to enter into the free trade agreement. As it turns out, as I understand it now, the film industry is going increasingly unionized, and so a number of film productions have been shut down, and the focus has gone back toward television. So this has been a really difficult year for Korean film, although there are some outstanding works. D-War was really popular. The film about Gwangju, Splendid Holiday, yeah. And a couple other things have done quite well and have managed to keep things afloat. But I think it was a big mistake to cut the screen quota. I'd like to see it at some point get restored. And from what I understand, CDMI and the Screen Quota Alliance Group, Alliance Action or Action Alliance, have said that they will work toward getting it restored. I don't know if they can, but I think with the change of administration, perhaps it's possible. But I do think that it would be good if it were put back, because in order for Korea to compete on an even playing field with Hollywood, I think the quota does allow that. It does not give them any sort of unfair advantage, because we're talking about two very different sized industries, and it's only fair that they would be able to hold on to that.
So you think that the screen quota system protects the industry in the end?
Not just the industry, but the culture. Because I think that when you go to see films, when you see what's presented as the norm over and over and over again, if that's something foreign, then that gets incorporated back into the popular culture, which was the case, I think, with Canada. And what happened in the 80s is happening now in Asia in general. There was a burst of really creative film production in Canada. We had a number of directors like Patricia Rosema, John Grayson, Guy Madden, who's still around, Bruce MacDonald, making very important films, and it seemed like there was going to be a growth in the industry. And then the United States realized, hey, it's really cheap to make TV programs up in Canada. And so now we have the Weinsteins discovering, hey, it's really cheap to make movies in Asia. Let's dump a bunch of money there and go over and pay these people $1.50, you know, for what we would have to pay Americans a lot more. So that's kind of... That's kind of upsetting because I hate to see that kind of exploitation take place. Maybe and it is on one hand, it is a very good opportunity for people working in Asia. On the other hand, where will that money go? It will come back to the United States. So it is sort of an additional problem along with the reduction of the screen quota. There's also another American studio that has set up production headquarters in Korea to remake old Hollywood pictures using Korean actors and some Korean directors to sell to a Korean audience. And it seems a little disingenuous because the idea seems to be that this will allow Koreans to think that they're going to see Korean films. At least that seems to be the one of the reasons for doing that. It's not just that we need another remake of Magnificent Obsession or something like that. You know, I suppose if they wanted to remake Waterloo Bridge, given the popularity, evidently that would be fine. But and I think that is a problem and that's tied into the screen quota.
So Korean melodramas seem to have found an audience in the U.S. Do you think this discovery of Korean melodramas will lead these audiences to rediscover historical American melodramas, classical American melodramas?
I would hope. I mean, I think that melodrama arises, as we see when we look back at American melodrama of the 50s, it tends to turn up at points when there is some sort of major social upheaval taking place or some social change. So as the U.S. was recovering from World War II and experiencing an economic boom, women were going into the workforce, there was this economic growth, there was the development of the teenager as a consumer, all these things got addressed in the family melodrama. And even though these were political and social issues, they were domesticated, they were put into the space of the home and worked out that way. What we're seeing in Korean film is sort of the same thing. There was the economic crisis in 97, and Korea is still sort of rediscovering who it is and deciding what direction to take. And so I think that's why it's been so popular. And so with that, because we are sort of having... We're never not having social problems anywhere at any time. And I think that maybe that will resonate with Americans... who are experiencing sort of the same kind of thing now. Yeah, that they can look at these dramas and sympathize with characters and with situations and apply them in their mind sort of intertextually to what's going on in their lives. So maybe it will redirect people. I think that we have Fassbender to thank that people even know who Douglas Sirk is now at all because of his interest in the 1970s. So maybe this interest can make people go back and look at what we've done before.
Would you point people to any particular American movies?
Well, I think a lot of... I think Sirk is interesting. Douglas Sirk's Imitation of Life, John Stahl's 1930s version is very interesting as well. We don't get the same kind of feeling of almost hopelessness in American melodrama. It's usually about a happy end, because at the end of Imitation of Life, even though the mother dies and the daughter's all upset, there's still this kind of artificial happy ending tacked on. They're all in the car together going home. At the end of Magnificent Obsession, she's been hit by a car, she's been blinded, but her boyfriend learns how to be a doctor and replaces her eyes or something. I don't know. Jane Wyman can see at the end. And even though she's hated Rock Hudson through the whole movie, they get married or something. You know, there's this happy ending somehow. But in Korean films, there's not that same kind of artificial happy ending tacked on. And there are a few American melodramas like that. A lot of old Susan Hayward films like My Foolish Heart or I Want to Live, they dared to have these at least ambivalent endings. And I think those are some of the most interesting films produced in the 40s, 50s, maybe up even into the 60s. We see the same kind of thing with, there's a really disturbing film from the late 40s called Leave Her to Heaven with Jean Tierney. And I remember when I showed that for class, my students were amazed because they said, we didn't know movies like this were made. We thought they were all these sort of happy romances. And also, too, there were some sort of strange Joan Crawford melodramas from the 50s, Harriet Craig, The Story of Esther Costello, that were sort of daring, cynical looks at American culture of the time. Consumerism, the role of the woman in the house, and the whole question of charity in the story of Esther Costello is really examined and comes out not looking too great. So,
do you think unhappy endings constitute some kind of obstacle to the further success of the Korean film industry in the U.S.?
I think that it does, yes, although the funny thing is, the last time I taught melodrama, by far the most popular films were the Korean ones. And when I asked the students which ones they liked the best and which ones they liked the least, Cirque came out on the bottom. Stella Dallas lost big time. I mean, that was the one they hated the most. And the films they did like were Shiware. They liked Over the Rainbow, which was kind of a comedy, but it had that sort of melodramatic overtones. Sad Movie was something they all loved. And in fact, when we showed it at the film festival, I had people in their 40s, 50s, and this woman who may have been in her 60s coming up, grabbing my arm, because I'd mentioned that in Korea it was not popular because it was considered to be not sad enough. And these people had been weeping their eyes out in the theater coming up going, my God, what did it need? The Twin Towers collapsing, this one woman said to me, and then she sort of like, you know, clasped her hand to her head, and she said, this was amazing. And a man came up who had obviously been crying his eyes out at the end. And I was very pleased because there was a woman who had been in my class, and she actually left the room at one point during the screening because she was very uncomfortable and had been crying. And she came back and she brought her boyfriend. He was this, you know, big guy with sort of, you know, shaved head and a leather jacket. And after it was over, I took her aside and I said, well, did you make it through it this time? And she said, oh, you know, I cried a lot. And she said, my boyfriend cried too. And I was really pleased that the films were able to touch an American audience that well, that effectively.
Despite all these problems, all these issues we've talked about, you still seem to be very optimistic about the future of the Korean film industry.
Yeah, yeah. I am. I can't wait to see. I hear there's going to be a new movie with Nam Moon-hee where she gets kidnapped, and it's supposed to be some sort of comedy thing, but you know it's going to be sad at the end. And Cruel Winter Blues, I thought, was an absolutely amazing film, and it was doing things that had not been done before. That was just last year, 2007. I never am disappointed, or at least I haven't been too much lately, in the films that I've seen. So I'm looking forward. There's a film called My Son that looks promising. I haven't seen it yet. It just came out on DVD. And as I mentioned, too, the film about Gwangju, Splendid Holiday, looks like it's going to be very good. And I hope it gets released here. It would be nice if it would.
I find this to be a particularly interesting juncture for us to be talking about the success of the Korean film industry right now. The New York Korean Film Festival has been running for the past couple of days. We've had a particularly interesting event with the director of 200 Pound Beauty, Kim Yong-hwa. It was pretty interesting to see him interact with people and the junior staff, and I think a lot of us were surprised at how friendly he was with us, considering the tremendous popularity of his film. He was a very down-to-earth character. So,
well, the guy who directed The Unforgiven, actually, we all went out drinking and went to this bar, and then I was gone when he came back on his way back to Korea, and they were out, and at like 2 o'clock in the morning, he insisted on making kimchi jjigae for everybody because he said nobody knew how to make it right. So they went looking for ingredients. And so it's great that, you know.
Are there any films in the New York Korean Film Festival that you would particularly recommend?
I loved 200 Pound Beauty. I thought it was a really funny film, and I know it has gotten some criticism. Some people didn't necessarily like it as much. They thought it was sort of a lightweight comedy, but I thought it was very funny. It incorporated elements. It reminded me of, I should say, a lot of old comedies from the 50s, some Frank Tashlin style things. And everybody in it just did an amazing job. I like the fact that the lead character doesn't have an identity, that she's a phone sex operator who has a fake identity. She's a singer who pretends to be a thin woman singing, and she doesn't have an identity. And she's this sort of unknown person that she is without. And her father, who has Alzheimer's, keeps mistaking her for her mother. And so finally she has this surgery to become somebody, and yet she takes her identity away. That it's only her voice, it's her singing voice that betrays her in a sense, and people realize that she is the person she was. The especially funny scene is where she's in the romantic scene with Jujin Mo, and she keeps remembering, oh, he can't touch my breasts because they're fake, and he can't touch my buttocks because they're fake. You know, and so it's almost like he's playing with the idea of the ideal woman is something that's not real, or that it's something beyond gender, that she's almost not a woman anymore. She's this automaton that looks like a model. And I actually have to confess, when I was looking at the DVD, I did not get the reference. There's the photograph of the two personas, and one says S-line and one says D-line, and I didn't know if that was like clothes sizes or what, so I called my friend Kyung Min, and he said, oh, you've got to understand, you know, this is Korean culture. He said S is considered the ideal shape for women's bodies, and D, haha, you know, would be like that she's fat. And I said, oh, all right, now I understand that the D is not actually used, but it's something that was evidently used for the film or made up for the film as some sort of play off of the S-line, this drive to be S-line. And this is something actually that I've been sort of fascinated with. It's when I visited Korea last year, they'd recently opened a Krispy Kreme donut store in Seoul, in the sort of Itaewon area. And no, actually it was in, it's near Myeongdong, Insadong. And my friend told me that young Korean women would go there and they would buy some huge pastry and go out and stand on the street and take one bite and then throw it away. There was this new type of conspicuous consumption that they didn't even like sweets, but it was this new sort of thing that was being done. So they were maintaining this idealized form while at the same time taking part in this consumerist drive. I got a big kick out of Like a Virgin. I thought it was a very funny little film. The performances were amazing. The man who plays the lead character's father is, I think, one of the most underrated Korean actors working, and unfortunately I can't remember his name right now. He's the guy who's the coach, but there's a guy who plays the alcoholic father. And he's just in a couple scenes, and he really does steal the film. He's wonderful. He's a really, yeah. Once in a Summer, I really did like Sue. I liked her since I saw her in The Love Letter on TV, and I think she does a great job. And I think A Tale of Two Sisters is an old TV drama with is Ji Jin Hee. He was in and he was in it with her and a third guy who hasn't done too much, I think, after that. There was it's a typical drama, so there's an orphan and... TV drama. And somebody goes to medical school and somebody doesn't, and someone gets some wasting disease, and there are a lot of tears, and a mother that they don't know, it's really their mother, and they may be brother and sister. You know, it's typical. You know, it's a Winter Sonata over again.
But you like this typicality, these archetypes.
It's reassuring, and it's interesting to see how that they play with it. That we know what's going to happen. I mean, you know every episode is going to end with a cliffhanger. And thank goodness it's available on DVD, because if I were watching in Korea, I'd go crazy having to wait from Monday to Tuesday to find out, you know, what was happening.
Is there a pleasure in recognizing the patterns?
I think that's true, and I think that's true of any film. I think that it's like the detective narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, it's written in such a way that if it turns out to be somebody that there's just absolutely no way that you could know who did it and that you didn't get any clues, it wouldn't be much fun. Right. But the idea that you master the text, and I think that's why people see things over and over again. And I think that that is also the appeal of melodrama, is that you never master it. You know, with a comedy, you can watch it and you laugh time and again, but I think the jokes eventually get stale. With horror films, after you've seen it the first time, it's not quite as scary when the guy with the white mask jumps out, you know. But with melodramas, you see them over and over again, and you're going to probably cry in the same place every time, you know. And I think that's what's really effective. You recognize it, and yet it's something you can repeat, and you can never, ever master it. It's like the ultimate fetish object, because it's about this repetition. It's about a comfortable repetition that gives you pleasure, and it just becomes sort of unending, you know. There's not a beginning and end. It's something that just goes on and on.
Well, this is very interesting. It's true that the Koreans do use formulas, but they seem to do it right. And if you use a formula and you do it right, you can watch a romantic comedy. You can watch romantic comedies over and over again.
It's true. You're absolutely right. And you're right. I mean, something, and they always throw a little twist in. I think they're really aware of the fact that they're working with formulas, and so they're very careful to take steps to throw some little thing in that makes it different. But they do keep that familiarity. They do keep that same form over and over again. And people may criticize it, but, you know, I mean, how many Bruce Willis Die Hard movies do we have? You know, and they still manage to make a huge amount of money. And you know, he's probably not going to die. You know, you have a good, good idea that it's not going to happen. So, you know, I think Tale of Two Sisters, too, just sort of looking back at the list, that I think is one of the greatest films ever made, bar none. I mean, any international film. The performances are first rate. The storyline is intriguing enough to keep your attention. If you pay attention at the end, it makes sense. A lot of people have complained that it makes no sense at all, but it really does make perfect sense. Everything is put together almost with surgical precision. If you look at it, there is a progression that builds in the middle, and there's a central turning point that changes everything. And I think the ending is one of the saddest endings I've ever seen. It's a very, very moving film. It's a wonderful film. It's too, is slated for a remake, and originally was supposed to star the Olsen twins, which I found fascinating. I really was hoping it would, because it would be high camp, but I've heard that now they are no longer with the project, which made me kind of sad. But I was looking forward to it. I think it'd be great. Get Faye Dunaway as their mom, and they'd have a blockbuster.
Did you see The Old Garden?
Yeah, I actually saw it, and I saw it about the same time as I saw Once in a Summer. I thought they were both really good, and Yum Jong-ah can be in anything. And when I first saw her in Tell Me Something, I just thought she was sort of one-dimensional and kind of scary looking. And then I saw Two Sisters, and I started to believe that she was very talented, but still very scary. And then she was in that, there was a movie about a teacher, Lovely Rivals is what the English title was. And she was just really cute in that and funny. And she was able to show that she had this much more three-dimensional style of performing. And in The Old Garden, I thought she was wonderful. I think she's great. And it is a very moving film, too. I mean, when they show the rows and rows and rows of graves and they're putting the single white flowers on, it was just a really arresting image, and it sticks with you. It was a much more, in its own way, it was a much more visual film than Once in a Summer, whereas Once in a Summer I thought was a more emotionally engaging film. So what were your favorites in the lineup?
A Dirty Carnival.
Yeah, Dirty Carnival.
The drama.
But the ending, you know, that final sequence, oh my gosh, you know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, you worry that it's going to happen, and then it does. And it's that awful feeling of recognition.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
so
you're...
Recognition can be...
Yeah. It's the... It's the kind of same thing I think at the end of Two Sisters, is that you're forced to occupy. You're put in a position where you're forced to look at a situation that you know is going to happen. You want to look away, but you can't. And I think the same thing happens. I think the film that it did it most effectively was Princess Aurora, where the whole film is leading up to this one little 3-minute segment in the middle of the film. We get this series of violent murders. It starts to look like a serial killer film. And then just at the point where, you know, you know who's doing the killing, you know how it's being done, and you know the motivation has something to do with this little girl's death, but you don't know what the specifics are about the child's death. And then we get this horrific scene where the woman has the flashback as her daughter. And we're forced to live through that experience from the beginning of it to the very end, to the police taking those crime scene photographs. And it's one of the most harrowing scenes ever. And it does then, I think, cause viewers to sympathize really strongly with that character. And it does sort of the same thing that we see in those films. And I think, too, that in general, Korean film has shown itself to be very, very adept at doing that kind of thing. Somehow, they're able to draw us in as viewers, to make us sympathize with these characters, and to look at things that we don't want to look at, and to realize things about ourselves that we don't necessarily want to admit.
This was the first time I had seen, Asian movie, not the Korean, without the happy ending. It was really like a slap in the face, right? I mean, we're more familiar with Asian cinema and Asian culture, so it's not that slap in the face. But I remember the first time, I was really offended. How could it possibly be that the two lovers die at the end, or all that idiot had to do was say "I love you," and the story would have like turned out completely different.
It's true. I think the worst case scenario in a recent Korean film, where it just, I think it's just the most horribly awful, sad ending, is at the end of this recent film called Maumi, about a dog. It's called Hardy Paws in English. There's midway, I guess I should say that I'm going to talk about the plot, and if somebody hasn't seen it, midway through the little boy steals a Labrador Retriever puppy for his sister, and in sort of a dramatic formula, they're orphans who are living, their mother has abandoned them, which is a common theme over and over again in Korean films, and that's unthinkable in American films to a certain degree, because we've got this mythology of the all-sacrificing mother, Stella Dallas, the mothers from Imitation of Life. All of these mothers who give up their lives to be with their children in Korean films, going even back as far as Miwoto Tashi Hanbon, is that what it's called? I Hate You, But Once Again, it was remade like 3 or 4 times, where a woman has a baby out of wedlock and she wants to give it back to the father because it'll have a better life. Oh, there's The World Without a Mother as well, where the mother dies and the father is handicapped or... This is an older one, slightly. But these mothers who... we have sort of the opposite thing happening. And so these two children are left alone, and the little boy brings a dog, and the dog becomes this new little sibling, almost. But as it grows up, then it becomes a kind of replacement for the mother. And the children are playing on the ice, and the little brother, the older brother, has to run off into the weeds because he has to go to the bathroom. The dog sees a kite and runs off to the thin ice and falls into the ice. And the little sister wanders over to try and save the dog and falls in and drowns. And it's this absolutely horrible scene because the older brother then runs to try and save her. And the fishermen who are ice fishing take this responsible role and keep him from going in. But in so doing, they assure that the little girl will die. So the dog, who's been so faithful and such a good parental figure up to this point, becomes a bad object. It survives. And so the brother hates the dog. He throws rocks at it. He, you know, doesn't want to feed it. The neighbors have moved away. There's nobody to take care of him and his sister. And so he runs away to Busan from Seoul. And the dog follows him because he's going to look to find his mother. His mother is now working kind of as an escort and she doesn't want to be bothered with a kid. And so he takes up with this group of homeless kids who are being exploited by a guy who also runs a dog fighting ring, as it turns out. The dog shows up. All these horrible things happen. And, of course, the dog dies. And the last scene of the film is the brother is sitting at the bus stop where he and his sister have waited. And he's talking to the dog and he's saying, you know, I'm sorry. And it's just really horrible. And the dog dies. And then the film cuts. There's this sort of lap dissolve, and it's not, I believe it's like not winter anymore. It changes, and it's cherry blossom time, and the cherry blossoms are falling, and the dog has just been asleep, and a bus pulls up, and the little girl gets off. It's the little sister, and she's like, oh, you've been waiting for me. And they all start laughing and running, and it's this really incredibly beautiful sequence. And then the little boy stops and turns around, and he's by himself on the road, and it's been imagined, and it cuts to black. And it's just horrific because it's given you this artificial happy ending, but then it shows you how artificial it is. And then over the black, the voiceover, the little girl saying, oh, it's okay, I'm here with a dog. But there's nothing reassuring about it.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.